From My Right at This by Christian Woolman. So long as faith is something that withstands the assaults of reason, experience, secularization, or even simple, the slope and erosion of certainty within my own heart and mind, so long as that verb accurately describes the dynamic between my belief and all that seems to threaten it, then faith is an illusion in me, a dream that weakness clings to, rather than the truest form and the fruition of strength. And then from the Bible, Matthew chapter 14, verses 22 through 33. Immediately Jesus made the disciples get into the boat and go on ahead of him to the other side, while he dismissed the crowd. After he had dismissed them, he went up on the mountainside by himself to pray. Later that night, he was there alone, and the boat was already a considerable distance from the land, buffeted by the waves because the wind was against it. Shortly before dawn, Jesus went out to them, walking on the lake. When the disciples saw him walking on the lake, they were terrified. "It's a ghost," they said, and cried out in fear. But Jesus immediately said to them, "Take courage, it is I, don't be afraid." "Lord, if it is you," Peter replied, "tell me to come to you on the water." "Come," he said. Then Peter got down out of the boat, walked on the water, and came toward Jesus. But when he saw the wind, he was afraid, and beginning to sink, cried out, "Lord, save me." Immediately Jesus reached out his hand and caught him. "You have little faith," he said, "why do you doubt?" And when they climbed into the boat, the wind died down. Then those who were in the boat worshipped him, saying, "Truly you are the Son of God."
Y'all are in for a treat today. I never get to preach Sunday mornings, but Neil begged me to give him a break, so here I am. Also, I tend to mumble a lot, so that's why I'm going to use this mic, because I don't want to really project. Lest you... All right, so my name's Tim. I'm one of the co-pastors here, and as you may or may not know, we're doing this sort of series on Christian vocabulary words. We started with, I forgot what we started with, eschatology, we did Satan, we did God. We're just going through them all. And so today we're doing two words, faith and grace, which I'll get into in a second here. Most of you all are aware that I have this certain religious past, right? Something I've talked about a lot in this community. If you haven't heard before, the real quick version is that I grew up sort of in fundamentalist, conservative, charismatic, which means like you believe in like speaking in tongues and the Holy Spirit and that sort of stuff, demons and that sort of thing. So I grew up in that kind of church. In my late college and post-college life, I what you would call turned away from that, and a lot of those beliefs, and had this real intense time of religious questioning and searching. So I've talked about that sort of thing a lot, but one thing I've not really ever mentioned, I think, in the church context, is that acknowledging the fact that even though in that turning, I felt like I was sort of moving into something better for me, even though I felt like I was finding something more authentic to myself or something more durable, lasting, despite this real genuine excitement that I had about this new discovery, there's also this intense and great sense of loss that comes with sort of changing in that way. And it's not just like a loss of the way of thinking or just one mode of thought. It's really sort of a loss of something super integral, super intimate to one's sense of who they are. This is something I'm still coming to terms with more and more now as I get older, because, you know, back then it was like exciting and I wasn't really thinking about that, but as I'm like, you know, it's been a while, I'm sort of realizing that that's a real part of how I view religion, this sort of loss that I've had before. And so the reality is also that, you know, religion, the religious stuff, this kind of stuff that we're talking about, what we're doing here, is in many ways less tangible now than it was back then. It was, this sort of thing is less readily in my hand. God, as much as God is real and alive, God is also shrouded in this intense ambiguity. I can't anymore easily point to something and say, this is God, right? Be it a fortuitous opportunity that presents itself, or good health, or lack of health, or tragedy, the things in life that make no sense, right? God is a part of these things. God is not a part of these things. God moves in this world. God doesn't move in this world. There's no real clear answer for a lot of those kinds of questions. No matter what people may say that is in the Bible, or a preacher may yell at you about, the ambiguity for me is really real. And in other ways, this reality for myself is not just mine, but it's a reality of the time that we live in. I think we find ourselves in a sort of age of what you might call indirect communication, right? Where these words that were given, that are handed down to us through time and history, and they no longer clearly point to the thing that they're always referring to. I believe now that in our moment, it's sort of distinctly like this, right? It's difficult for us to speak about something like God or religion or these vocabulary words. They don't mean the same thing that they once did, and we don't all agree on them anymore. And so we can't just be like, God, yes, and everyone's like, that's God, right? We're in this communal search for it, right? It's always there and always not there at the same time. The writer and poet who Sarah Ann read for us, Christian Wiman, he puts it this way. This is a quote. Does the decay of belief among educated people in the West precede the decay of language used to define and explore belief? Or do we find the fire of belief fading in us only because the words are sodden with overuse and imprecision and will not burn? We need a poetics of belief, language capacious enough to include a mystery that ultimately defeats it, and sufficiently intimate and inclusive to serve not only as individual expression, but as communal need. These difficulties of expression, right, these words that are less clear, these ambiguous theologies that present themselves, you know, they can feel, again, like not just a loss, but also a sort of absence. The famous quote from the psalmist, I think Psalm 10, "Why, Lord, do you stand far off? Why do you hide yourself in times of trouble?" The Christian philosopher Simone Weil, she wrote that absence is the form that God takes in this world, right? She's writing this in the early 20th century. Mother Teresa, we now famously know, was writing these letters during her lifetime, where she was making deep and intense admissions of this estrangement that she was feeling, this absence, right? She's writing in a letter to a minister, she says, "Jesus has a very special love for you. As for me, the silence and the emptiness is so great that I look and do not see, listen and do not hear." If I was to add my own confession to that list, I would say something like, "God, could you maybe just make it a little bit easier for me to see you?" So Neil and I did a video together this week. I don't know if you saw it. I highly recommend it. Our comedy stylings are unparalleled. It's chemistry of forged in sweat and tears. But you can go see it on YouTube. And in the video, I jokingly say to Neil, like, "Hey, I'm preaching on faith and grace this week. Do you have any suggestions for me about what to talk about?" And he says something like, "Don't talk about it, just show us." Which, if you see in my reaction in the video, I found kind of annoying and very unhelpful. But in some ways, you know, that's sort of what Wiman and Weil and all these other people are sort of alluding to, right? That words like grace and faith, because their meanings are hard for us to grasp now, their empowerment is not in their definitions as much as in their actions. They are made real, right, by we see in the story from Matthew, right, stepping out of the boat into the water. It's interesting, if you look at a lot of like traditional Christian doctrines, these concepts are also said to be made real only through the action of them, right? God's grace upon the world is what allows faith to exist, and by this faith we come to know a truth that we're told sets us free. Because one way to say it is, because I have been shown this one thing, I myself can now do this other thing. Because I have been shown grace, I can myself now do, which is to live a life of faith, right? In this light, the question of what grace and faith are, you know, I sort of reorient them into these questions, right? What is it that we are being shown? And how is it that we are to live? What is it that we're being shown? And how is it that we are to live? At the heart of the Christian story, I interpret that there's this idea, right? That the central idea, very simple but powerful, that there's more for us out there than we're aware of, that there's a life to be lived that is better than the one that we are living now, that looked in a new light, the world contains a richness, a depth, this deep current of love that is so often obscured by our eyes, right? That's dimmed by the blight of injustice and oppression, by boredom, by anxiety. The story that we're told is that God is not absent, right, but in fact present in the smallest things that we see, the smallest acts of love that we have, from that all the way to the grandest majesty of nature or mountains or the cosmos. We contain within ourselves, I think, part of this story, this hope in change, right, that the ever-present moment can get better, right, that the part that is difficult to see is the part that's going to win out. And we imagine that sort of reality, right? We sort of work in our lives and we strive towards it. It's often said that we have faith in it. However, it's not a faith, I think, that that reality will come true. It's not a faith in that end, but it's a faith in that possibility. This is also a quote from Christian Wiman. He says, "Faith is not faith in some state beyond change. Faith is faith in change." Faith to me is an action-oriented thing, right? It's this action towards changing, right? The famous words of St. Paul in, correct me if I'm wrong, Romans, I think it is, who said, "Faith without works is dead," right? Is that right? Ephesians, Galatians, whatever, right? Wow. I wish I had run that by someone earlier. James, it's been a while, guys. I appreciate that there is some biblical knowledge in this group. I thought it was lacking. James, in the book of James, right, we're told faith without works is dead, a famous quote. However, I think that when we hear that, we sort of lack the sense of the severity of that statement, right? It's not that a faith without works is somehow deficient or less, right? It's that it's dead, right? It doesn't actually exist, right? That's a really important distinction, right? There's also this other sort of definition of faith that we hear often, right? To believe in that which is unseen. This is a sort of common definition of faith given, but I don't think it has that imperative that James, in the book of James, that we're told, right? To say that, to believe in that which is unseen, I think, too often is used as an excuse for arrogance, to sort of shut down conversation, dialogue, growth, relationship, right? To me, the unseen, if it is God, is not a God in the clouds that we believe in, even though we can't see God. The God that we believe in is the God of change, the God of transformation, of possibility. If faith is believing that which we can't see, I would reframe it to say faith is actually striving towards that which we want to see happen. In relationship to that striving, that movement, that action, grace is this necessary component. If grace is something that reminds us of why we're striving in the first place. In some Christian theologies, again, we only have faith because we're given it by as a gift, right? We only are capable of having this faith because God has graced us with it. And indeed, if that's true, I want to argue that, or make the case that it's actually in remembering that gift, in recalling it, that grace appears. So a definition of grace often given, I've talked about this before, if you remember, the act of being given something we do not deserve. So this takes on this strange character of remembering, right? Because we were given something, and then we remember that experience of being given it, and then we can point to that experience and say, that was a moment of grace. So I know it sounds a little abstract. Let me give you an example, okay? So I'm sure most of us have had this, right? You hear a song that you haven't heard in a while. It's a song that then sort of transports you into the moment of hearing that song, right? It can be so intense as to, you can almost like remember what the weather was like when you heard it and sort of all the small details of your environment when you heard it and the very feelings you had. Recently, I've been listening to a lot of Blink-182's old canon. Something triggered it for me, right? But I've been sort of binge listening to a lot of that. And when I do that, I'm taking back to high school, driving down the highway in Southern California. The weather's amazing. We're driving really fast. My friend had this pickup truck that was painted like camouflage. And we would just like blare Blink-182 and just yell all the cuss words as loud as we could as we went to a skateboard shop. That was my high school life, my friends. And so whenever I hear that sort of now grating pop punk, right, I feel innocent again, I feel happy again, even if just for that moment, you know. Grace works in that same way. The gift that's given to us, right, the gift that we didn't deserve, right, it's just that, it's a gift. It's actually when we remember it, when we experience that moment again, when we think about it and it's recalled for us, that's when we point to it and say, that was a moment of grace. I'm arguing for this slight distinction between the event and the memory of the event, because I think it's important to remember that sort of memory of things is what keeps us moving. We have faith in the possibility of change. We fight for a better thing because we have experienced a little bit of it before. Maybe not in its entirety, perhaps only just a taste, but we have tasted a bit, and in remembering it, we're compelled to strive towards more. We're compelled to strive towards finding it again. We've been thinking a lot in this last year to think about what it would look like for Root and Branch to do justice work, work in the community, work for bettering the lives of people. And I have to confess that whenever I think about this and go into a lot of deep thought about it, I have this moment of despair, right? Because the amount of things that need to be changed, the amount of things that we could do, the causes that we could participate in are endless. In some ways, right? The amount of things that need change are just everywhere. And the powers that stand in the way of that change often seem so insurmountable, right? And in that, when I think about that, I just feel so small and useless. And yet, I still want to affirm that I have faith in this change, that I still have faith in doing that work. But without grace, without remembering times that I've seen where justice has actually shown itself, faith would be lost very quickly for me. In the absence of God, in the moment when we cry out, why do you hide yourself in times of trouble, do we lose faith in that? I think sometimes we do. I think we all know people who have. It's very possible. But grace, it abounds for us, but also is something that demands cultivation, right? We have to sort of step into it. We have to have a way of orienting ourselves that makes grace possible for us. There's a philosopher, William James, who once talked about, in this interesting way, these types of situations that are actually altered by our orientation towards them, that are made true by us acting. For example, he uses this example, and the question between two people, do you like me? He writes, right, do you like me? The possibility of that answer being yes really depends on one person facing the other in such a way that they think this person likes them, right? James says this, if one stands aloof and refuses to budge until she has objective evidence of that person liking them, then that evidence will most likely never come. It's only when we step out into something that we are met by the truth of it. In that same way, we can cultivate grace by taking risks to put ourselves in situations where Even though there may be no guarantee, a gift can be given, where faith can arise. This is, I think, one way I could say that we can make it a little easier to see God. I remember, and sometimes with only with a lot of effort, a God who is not absent. I remember, and I can recall, the sort of God whose promise is to us that those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength. They will soar on wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary, right? This is a passage that President Obama quoted recently in his speech in Selma. A reminder, I think, again, sort of a recall, a commitment to those who are under oppression, who have faced persecution, to remember to keep moving, to keep marching. When things seem absurd, impossible, by grace, we can go back to the times when we've seen impossibility become real, right? I think about, you know, there's biblical stories of this, right? The Exodus by the Israelites, right? Or also to today, the proliferation of marriage equality in America. I can remember 2008 being in California for that fight and thinking this is never gonna happen. And yet here we are on the brink of almost the entire nation coming to marriage equality. Truly, one thing that seemed impossible if you asked someone 10 years ago to now being on the cusp. Unthinkable in one moment and yet made real. We have to not forget things like that. We can't be distracted like Peter walking out on the out of the boat by the wind, seized by fear, incapable of remembering these things. We must keep them close. So what is it, again, what is it that we're being shown and how is it that we are to live? I think the simple answer I'm trying to get at is that we're being shown that the impossible has become possible before. And we are being asked to live in such a way that it can be possible again. So, my last sentence here, let us keep moving in faith, and by grace, let us remember why. Amen.